You can bet the president is going to be happy he doesn't have to listen to this song after this week.
100 days, 100 nights to know a man's heart.
The first 100 days of the Obama administration. $2 trillion budget, financial crisis, auto industry crash, global flu outbreaks, troubles in Pakistan.
Maybe I need to slow it down just a little, take my time.
Slowing it down? Not a chance. This is The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, April 27th. Short of the 100 days, we've got a flu outbreak. We're going to have all the details on the swine flu that's emerged in Mexico and is sweeping the globe. The numbers are disturbing. The NFL draft finished up this weekend. We'll talk about the Detroit Lions' acquisition of Georgia quarterback Matt Stafford. This week marks our one-year anniversary, and some people who we've spoken with over the course of the year are some great economic indicators. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines. The world is gearing up to deal with an outbreak of swine flu. Peter Cordingley, a spokesman for the World Health Organization, says it poses a challenge for all nations.
It's quite clear that there is the potential for this virus to become a pandemic and threaten globally, but we honestly don't know. We don't know enough yet about how this virus operates. More work needs to be done.
A pandemic, by definition, crosses national and continental borders. This outbreak isn't there yet, but governments are taking precautions. The U.S. declared a public health emergency yesterday as 20 cases were confirmed here. President Obama is expected to address it later today. General Motors will announce details of its restructuring plan today. The company is expected to eliminate its storied Pontiac brand, which first emerged in 1926. Femi Oke is here to help me out. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, John. I have some more news from Detroit. Chrysler has struck a tentative agreement with the United Auto Workers Union that meets federal requirements for Chrysler to receive more financing, and that moves the company closer to forging a partnership with the Italian carmaker Fiat, and Chrysler must present its plan by Thursday. The World Bank is urging wealthy countries to provide help to poorer nations. President Robert Zoellick spoke at the end of the IMF's group spring meeting.
There is a widespread recognition that the world faces an unprecedented economic crisis. Poor people could suffer the most, and we must continue to act in real time to prevent a human catastrophe.
The World Bank says that an extra 53 million people are at risk of extreme poverty because of the economic crisis, and Africa is especially at risk as government budgets fall short across the continent.
Markets are having jitters because of the concerns about swine flu. The Dow and S&P both went up more than 1% on Friday. Will probably not be the case this morning when Wall Street begins in about an hour and a half's time. The S&P begins trading at 866. The swine flu has the world on edge, and you have questions.
This is Chris from Highbridge, New Jersey, and I've been hearing that people should avoid eating pork because of the swine flu outbreak, and I'm wondering, do I have to throw out the pork chops I bought on Friday?
As long as you cook and prepare your pork, 160 degrees internal temperature, it's safe. You don't have to throw it out. Other questions at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Here in the United States, we fully expect to see more cases in more states. Some of those cases might be severe, and we probably will not be surprised if we actually see some deaths associated with this.
That's Tom Skinner, a spokesperson for the Centers for Disease Control, who spoke to The Takeaway earlier this morning. The numbers as we know them right now haven't changed much since late Sunday night. The outbreak has killed more than 100 people in Mexico, 22 confirmed from the swine flu, according to the New York Times. More than 1,600 people believed to have contracted the virus around the world. Or 1,600 people in Mexico. Around the world, there are more cases. It's not clear how they're connected. Spain's health ministry has confirmed the nation's first case of swine flu, and there are 20 confirmed cases here in the United States, in five states, from California to New York, Ohio, and Texas. So world health officials, looking at these numbers, are bracing for a potential, and let's just say potential, worldwide pandemic of the swine flu. And the number of fatalities in Mexico means it's definitely something that infectious disease experts are keeping an eye on. Dr. Richard Wenzel, an epidemiologist, immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases and chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, joins us once again from Richmond. Dr. Wenzel, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. A pleasure.
And let's talk about, first of all, the issue of these particular numbers here. Does the number of fatalities in Mexico and the fact that the fatalities seem to be isolated to Mexico concern you in any way?
It does. I think we have to look at that very carefully. It says a couple of things. One is it's likely that the number of cases is underestimated in Mexico, because If this is a very severe virus with a 1% mortality, then the 100 deaths really represent 10,000 cases.
Wow.
If, in fact, it's a run-of-the-mill virus and for some reason we just see the tip of the iceberg, that means, you know, with a 0.1% mortality, what we see in our country annually, that means the real numbers could be as high as 100,000. Whatever the scenario, the number of cases is bigger in Mexico than 1,200.
So you're talking about the sort of statistical snapshot that's represented by these numbers and how incomplete a picture we have so far. Let's take a look at what's actually going on with individual cases inside Mexico City. And I know you heard our colleague from Time Magazine, Ian Griot, mention this earlier this morning, and I want to get your direct response to it.
Most of them are young men and women, particularly young men in their prime, people 30 years old, 35 years old, who would seemingly be very healthy.
Now, those are the people that are dying, according to Ian Griot, people in the prime of life in their 30s, particularly men. What's your response when you hear that statistic?
Well, first of all, why young people are getting this at all, rather than older people. The suspicion would be that older people, older than 50, may have developed some partial immunity as a result of prior exposure to related virus. Therefore, young people are disproportionately susceptible. Now, once they get infected, why are young people dying? This is really a mystery. But one of the possibilities is, as we saw in H5N1, the avian flu, young people have a very robust immune system. And it may be that it overreacted to the virus and actually damages the body's repair system.
Hmm. So the question also of transmission is really, really interesting here. In avian flu, transmission was difficult. I mean, the humans that died of avian flu, it's my understanding, had to have really intense contact with birds. What's the indication on the mode of transmission for this swine flu, as far as you can understand it?
Well, this is clearly going person to person. How sustained it'll be, I don't think anyone knows. But now we know it's on three continents. If we've got Europe involved in New Zealand, the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So I think this is quite serious. There's clearly person-to-person transmission. It's probably close transmission, 3 to 4 feet away from someone who's coughing or speaking loudly or singing.
Wow. Let's talk about the clock that ticks on any of these viruses that are involved with the flu for mutation. You would expect, epidemiologists would expect, that mutations would begin to occur. Assuming we're catching this in the beginning, at what point do we begin to look for mutations, either that could be more severe or that would make the disease relatively harmless?
Well, we're continually looking at that. And with flu, what I've said before, anyone who boldly tries to predict influenza does so at his own peril. This virus loves to change and has the ability to adapt quickly. It could get worse, as the 1918 strain of influenza that was a real pandemic, or it could fizzle out perhaps a little bit more like the 1976 swine flu epidemic in the United States that really never materialized.
Dr. Wenzel, how's your bedside manner this morning?
It's terrific.
Got a question from one of our listeners. We have vacation plans for L.A. San Diego area for the week of May 9th. I was worried about the swine flu outbreak in Southern California and was wondering if I should cancel the plans. What would you advise our listener?
Well, I don't think I would cancel plans for flights in the United States at this point. There's still a limited number of cases there. If you wanted to wait till the last second, that'd be reasonable.
From our listener, Scott, does immunization matter, Dr. Wenzel? Have the people who've been affected, have they already been given the seasonal flu virus? Do we know that information? And is there any indication that if you've had a flu vaccine, that it can help you here?
I don't think we know yet. I've seen people on both sides of the argument say that there might be, or there's no indication, but I think it would be wise to think that we have no compelling information that it will be protective.
Dr. Wenzel, thanks so much. As always, we go live now to Mexico City. Roz Atkins, our colleague at the BBC, joins us from World Have Your Say. Roz, you're down in Mexico City at a time when we've heard that the mentality of the entire huge city has been gripped by this. What are you seeing?
Hi, good to speak to you. I think it's fair to say people are gripped, but in a very calm and cautious way. I haven't seen any evidence of panic in the few days that I've been here. People seem very keen to get good advice, whether from the health authorities or from the president. Many people are opting not to go to work, maybe not to go outside. There's been soaring rates of takeaway food and video rentals because some people are just opting not to go anywhere. So it's more caution than any sort of panic. And I'm joined here sitting on our hotel roof as a very, very slow Monday morning gets underway by Dr. Francisco Moreno. Sir, good to speak to you. You're here very early because it didn't take you any time to get here.
No, the city is very quiet. This seems to be something unusual. Usually Monday it takes about 50 minute ride to get from where I live to get here. Then it took me about 15 minutes.
And many people listening to The Takeaway will be incredibly concerned about swine flu. What can you tell Americans about this virus? Should they be worried?
Well, there are three things that concerns me. First, this is a new virus. This is something that we don't know how it's going to be progressing. Secondly, we're talking about the most crowded city in the world. And third, there have been people, young people, affected. So it's not the virus that just affect people that are in older ages or the very young ages. This seems to be affecting young, healthy people. And this is very concerning.
And I have to tell those of you listening to The Takeaway, the main headline here this morning is that the authorities are considering shutting down all businesses in Mexico City. Already the schools and many offices are shut, but they're considering closing everything down. Doctor, do you think that would be justified?
Well, Roz, can I just add to that question? Because the clinicians we've been talking to all morning are suggesting that based on these numbers, there could really be more like 100,000 cases, that we're really seeing the tip of the iceberg. Just fold that into your question, Roz.
Yes, well, the thing is that we're reporting probably most of the severe cases, the cases that have required being hospitalized and probably being on an intensive care unit. And there are many cases, mild cases, that have been seen like just a normal respiratory disease, and they have had, in fact, influenza. So this is possibly true.
And to all of you listening, we're posting videos all the time. If you'd like to see us report from Mexico City, you can do so on the blog at worldhaveyoursay.com. Good to speak to you on The Takeaway again.
And we will be linked to that blog at thetakeaway.org as well. So if you want to follow the developments in Mexico City or any of the developments taking place around the United States, we are following the swine flu that has broken out in Mexico City. And as you're hearing there, in Mexico City, they are considering some very, very serious efforts to shut down activities in the city as a precautionary measure. Roz Atkins was talking about how things are calm in Mexico City at this point, but Dr. Richard Wenzel, who was here just a moment ago, immediate past president of the International Society for Infectious Diseases and chairman of internal medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, was saying we don't know the numbers at this point. Stay tuned to The Takeaway. Your questions on what to do in the wake of these outbreaks around the world at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The swine flu has got the world on edge. Markets are jittery, but what about actual people concerned about actually getting sick? We have questions from you, our listeners. Debbie says, my son has a honeymoon trip booked. Are cruise ships still going to Mexico? From our website. Well, the answer to that is the CDC hasn't announced travel restrictions, and cruisecritic.com has a story on this from yesterday. It says no cruise lines have announced itinerary changes, though both Princess and Royal Caribbean have told us, that is cruisecritic.com, that they are monitoring the situation closely. That's a quote there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let's share information. We'll put our heads together here and we can figure out what to do in this crisis. It's not actually a crisis. It's an outbreak, which is short of an epidemic, which is short of a pandemic. We'll keep that straight throughout the hour. So big sports weekend, batting practice at Fenway Park as the Boston Red Sox swept the New York Yankees on their home turf. Celtics and Bulls tied their NBA playoff series. The Stanley Cup playoffs proceed. But the NFL draft was the biggest story, and it probably got bigger ratings than a lot of those games I was talking about. Biggest news in the draft, after their abysmal 0-16 season, the Detroit Lions, who of course got the first pick. If you do that badly, you get a first pick. They ponied up a guaranteed $41.7 million for Georgia quarterback Matt Stafford. And the New York Jets traded with Cleveland, whose coach they fired in January, to take Southern California quarterback Mark Sanchez. That's a lot of sports over the weekend. And here to talk about it is Takeaway contributor Ibrahim Abdelmateen. He's here in the studio. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning. Good morning.
Let's talk about the sort of the headlines, and that gets to the deeper story that you want to talk about. Matt Stafford, is he worth it? $41 million? That's guaranteed money, right?
If you're 0-16, Matt Stafford is the guy.
Now, is he about winning games or is he about filling the seats?
He's got, well, that's an interesting question. He definitely can throw the ball. He can run the ball. He can direct an offense. I think he's about winning games. And fundamentally for them, they just need to compete. They need to win a game.
Do they have a line to protect him? In other words, is his doctor advising him to maybe, you know, wear armor made out of titanium?
Don't expect Stafford to come out of the gate being like an Aikman or any of these great quarterbacks that we remember. He's going to have a tough year first year, and he might take a lot of licks.
All right. Can this turn Detroit around?
Well, you know, Detroit's been in a hole for quite some time. I think when you look for a quarterback to go first, I think in the history in the past 10 years, only Eli Manning has taken their team to the Super Bowl.
Right.
So if he's that kind of guy, we'll see. I'm not sure. But he definitely will start the process and bring energy back to Detroit.
And for 2 years, Eli was like the most ridiculous decision the Giants ever made. And then he became like the most brilliant idea. So it's a terrifying road for Mr. Stafford, even with the $41.7 million. The New York Jets traded up or down, I don't know what you'd call it, to get Southern Cal quarterback Mark Sanchez, who's an interesting ethnic story in addition to his talents on the field.
Certainly. I think, so some people are they're in a position where they have no other choice but to trade over.
Mm-hmm.
So they take some of their picks for next year or later on this year, and they get a guy like a Mark Sanchez. Sanchez, who is the first Mexican-American, the first one to go this high in the draft, a USC guy, Southern California guy from high school. But mind you, Pete Carroll, who's his coach, who was a former NFL guy, thinks that he's not ready to go to the NFL.
Hmm. You know, Gustavo Arellano, who's our friend on The Takeaway, has got a blog in L.A. called Ask a Mexican. He described Mark Sanchez as quarterbacking while Mexican. Is there a Hispanic audience that wants him to succeed?
When you talk about the NFL draft, you talk about blue chip players and assets, you talk about franchise players, impact players, you don't really talk about the ethnicity of the player,
right.
Except that, and when it's a Mexican-American and he's from Southern California, I think it matters.
Interesting. All right, but this was the year of middle-level players. The offensive line and receivers did particularly well. What does that say about the style of play in the NFL?
Well, you have, I think, in the NFL right now, you have a two-back style offense. You have a very different type of offense than you've had in the past. A lot of running backs weren't picked, and I think that just shows that the speed isn't there as much. The overall talent level is down. The players that were picked are what you call solid starters, people that are going to be solid for you for a couple of years and give you good playing time.
You know, maybe what the NFL is figuring out is that when, I guess, the average weight of a player is something like, you know, 290, 300. I mean, there are these huge offensive line people wandering around stomping on players. I mean, you can't. It doesn't matter if you're that fast. You got to keep from getting hurt. That's job one in the NFL.
With the offensive line guys, they're going straight ahead. They're going straight at you. So they have a less. Their potential for injury is a much less. With a defensive line and linebackers, those positions were also picked up. And a lot of those guys, they're going to go lateral. They're going to last. They're going to last less in the league than the offensive line guys.
Who did the best team wise?
Well,
said the Jets did.
A lot of people are saying the Jets did really well. The Giants did great. The Eagles did really good. The Denver Broncos did not do really well. I think when you pick a high pick and then your lower picks you send them away, you're setting yourself up for trouble.
A lot of people pay attention to the Dallas Cowboys. I certainly don't. But what did they do in the draft?
They didn't make any sort of exciting moves at all. I think they just filled in positions where they had need. It's just like the normal story of the draft. It's like, how fast are they? What's their jumping ability? But, you know, you pull in guys that may or may not help you.
So every year when the draft happens, do you like look at your phone and go, I could have been there. I could have done that.
You're asking a
tell the story. Come on.
Well, okay. So there was once upon a time when Ibrahim was able to make a decision between putting my name on the list or not, and I had to make the decision not to.
You were coming out of what college?
University of Rhode Island.
University of Rhode Island. And did you want to be in the NFL?
I had no desire to be in the NFL.
Why?
Because my dream of playing football was to get a full scholarship to college, and that's what happened.
And so you graduated, and now?
And now I'm using my brain to make my money.
Smart guy, takeaway contributor. Instead of getting stomped on the field, Ibrahim, as always, thanks so much for being with us. Ibrahim Abdelmateen is a blogger and takeaway contributor, and he joined us right in the studio to talk about his weekend NFL draft picks. Headlines now from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. In Detroit, details of the GM restructuring plans are emerging. Early sources say that GM will cut 21,000 hourly jobs and dump its Pontiac brand by the end of 2010. The plan will be released in about half an hour. Governments are racing to contain pockets of the swine flu around the world. So far, deaths have only been reported in Mexico, where the virus is suspected of killing at least 100 people. Peter Cordingley is the spokesman for the World Health Organization. He says the swine flu could turn up anywhere.
At any one moment, we believe there are perhaps 500,000 people traveling in aircraft. So quite clearly, it doesn't matter where you live, whether it's Asia or South America, this virus has the potential to reach you if it becomes extremely transmissible.
And here in the US, the government has launched flu screens along its borders and declared a state of emergency. And the move frees up around about 12 million doses of flu-fighting medications from a federal stockpile, but no U.S. deaths, from swine flu. In international news in the Middle East, military officials say that the U.S. and Iraq will begin renegotiating the terms of the June the 30th deadline for pulling U.S. combat troops out of Iraqi cities. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Those are flu screens on the border?
Yeah.
Flu screens?
Yes, so they're just watching.
Interesting. Thanks, Ben.
Yeah.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Swine flu, that's the big story this morning. It's got the world on edge. A number of takeaways already in our discussions about what's going on. Young people can be affected, not so much because of the virus itself, but because of their overwhelming internal immune reaction. And that seems to be one of the complications down in Mexico, where there are a number of fatalities. Expected to be more announcements from the CDC and the government today. We'll have them all. There's plenty we don't know about this outbreak in Mexico and this outbreak in the United States and in other countries around the country, or in other countries around the world. We have experts and reporters on throughout the morning, and we want to know, what questions do you have specifically? What do you want to do today that you're worried about? What sorts of things do you wish you could have some advice on? We'll try to answer those questions throughout the day. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your question at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So this week we are marking our one-year anniversary. And when you've been on the air for a year, you talk to a lot of people. And some of the people become friends. Some of the people become economic indicators. Their stories in particular communities around the world are an indication of what's going on in the economy much more generally. And we have a number of people who would answer that description, including Jesse Acosta, who's a student in the class of 2009 at the Yale School of Management. He claims he's going to be working at J.P. Morgan after he graduates next month. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Back in September when we spoke to you, the question really was, have you come up with a plan B? Because the financial system seemed to be completely going out of existence. At that time, what did you tell us?
I could have told you a variety of things, to tell you the truth. I think ultimately I did say that I was expecting to have a plan B and perhaps even a plan C lined up just in case, given the volatility at the time. And even now, there's just no telling. But I think as the months progressed, I felt a little bit more certain that things were going to hold up.
And will you be an investment banker, or are you going to be doing something different than you had imagined back in September when we spoke?
No, the offer I received this summer from J.P. Morgan will place me within the mergers and acquisitions group within the investment bank.
And that's mergers and acquisitions, not murders and acquisitions, right?
That's correct.
Right. I just want to make that clear. How has your business school experience changed in this last 9 months?
That's interesting. I think there's a call really to arms, I think, amongst the academic community to really get business schools online with really going back, if they ever did this, to preaching risk management and I think really trying to implement a little bit more from an ethical standpoint, some of the lessons learned from this. It's interesting. I like to tell people, especially when I'm promoting the school, that's really kind of an underlying tone that you see here at Yale's School of Management. I think it's where you make a lot of different changes, as will every other business school. The underlying tone here really has kind of implemented that idea that a lot of what you're about to enter isn't just about making money. It's really about doing well ethically. And so that undertone is very obvious here when you get here.
Well, good luck to you, Jesse Acosta. You're already one of the lucky ones. Thanks so much for speaking with us again on our anniversary week here. He's a student in the class of 2009 at Yale School of Management. He will be working at J.P. Morgan after he graduates next month. Jesse, thanks so much.
Thanks again for having me.
So you may remember this fellow who talked with us back in September also about his own particular economic story.
We are a growing company, and we're doing well. And even in this economic climate, we're hunkering down, and we're going to get through this.
Small businessman Jim Svets, an entrepreneur, former CEO of a company called Muddy Cup, now co-owner of the wine bar Chill. He was last on the show in December. There he was talking in September about the difficulties of being a small businessman in this environment. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So open your window on the economy where you are in upstate New York, Beacon, New York, and how are things doing?
Things are actually doing pretty well up here, believe it or not. We had a couple businesses close here on Main Street here and there, but we've actually had 8 new businesses, including ours, open in the last 6 months.
Now, so what kind of business is closed? What kind of business is closed, and what kind are opening up? What does that tell you?
Were the ones I would consider like unnecessary retail, like gift stores, things that you don't stuff. They sell things maybe a little expensive that you don't really need to live your life. So I think those tended to close. New stores that opened up were a couple consignment shops, some new food retail places opened up, Chill Wine Bar that we have opened, another place called Poppy's, a gourmet hamburger place opened up. So things that opened up that are a little bit more in line with the economics of the day as well.
Now, Jim Svetz, I've read a number of analyses of retail, and that alcohol is doing very well in this environment. It seems like you're riding a bit of a tsunami of misery here, Jim. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, well, alcohol in general, yes. Not high-end alcohol. I think the days of $400 bottle of vodkas and things like that are gone. When we opened the wine bar this winter, obviously, we came in at, we have $5 glasses of wine on our wine list. We knew that we had to come in at a good price point and offer the customer value, and so we did. And, yeah, I think reasonably priced, good value wine and liquor, I think, will always do well.
So Jim, are you able to get credit? You're in a segment of the market and of the economy that seems to me to be most vulnerable in the credit crisis that's so much talked about. Or are you taking advantage of community banks, which seem to be flush with cash?
We're not taking any advantage of any bank or any credit cards. We've decided that credit cards are out. We're not using them anymore. In my personal life, I've gotten rid of all of them. If you don't have the money to do something, don't do it.
Wow. So cash on the barrelhead is the new business model.
Yes, that absolutely. Yep.
Jim Svetz, thanks so much. Jim Svetz, an entrepreneur and former CEO of Muddy Cup, but currently the co-owner of the wine bar Chill, which seems to be doing just fine up there in Beacon, New York. Jim, one of our friends from a year on the air, thanks for joining us. And now Femi Oke, a year on the air with Femi, and time for some headlines.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. It's been good sharing my year with you. Good morning, everybody. In Detroit, we're starting to get some details on the GM restructuring plan. Early sources say that GM will cut 21,000 hourly jobs and also drop its Pontiac brand by the end of 2010. Look out for the full plan at the top of the hour. And Chrysler says that it's worked out a deal with the UAW that meets requirements set by the government to get another $6 billion in federal aid. And the deal modifies the union contract and reduces health fund payouts for retirees. The White House is stepping up border screenings, trying to identify travellers who may be infected with swine flu. The US has declared a state of emergency yesterday, a public health emergency, yesterday. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano.
We're leaning forward, we're preparing in an environment where we really don't know ultimately what the size or seriousness of this outbreak is going to be.
So far, 20 cases have been reported in the U.S., but in Mexico, swine flu is suspected in at least 100 deaths. And EU officials are urging Europeans not to travel to the U.S. or Mexico unless their travel is essential. Officials from across the globe gather in D.C. today for the Major Economies Forum. Representatives will be looking for a clue about possible U.S. participation in the Kyoto Protocol. The protocol is up for renewal. President Obama hosts foreign ministers at the White House this evening. That's a look at big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now is Micheline Maynard, New York Times senior business correspondent from Detroit. You've been hearing all morning from Femi Oke the reports from GM and Chrysler. GM saying perhaps it's going to lose the Pontiac mark, and Chrysler apparently making a deal with the UAW to possibly go forward with its deal with Fiat. Micheline, let's start with the Chrysler. The UAW story seems to be confirmed. What concessions has the union offered Chrysler, and how might it help with the Fiat deal?
Earlier in the year, Ford Motor Company workers approved a series of concessions, and we believe that the concessions offered by the workers at Chrysler are very similar to those. And some of the things that they gave up were cost of living allowance that they receive on top of their hourly wage, things like tuition assistance. And apparently these concessions are pretty valuable to people. One of the workers at Ford that we talked to said they are worth about $12,000 to him. So, you know, this isn't minor stuff.
And in terms of getting Chrysler closer to some sort of moment of truth, any sense of the value of these concessions or Fiat's likelihood to maybe go ahead with a deal? I mean, who's pulling the switch here?
well, the government is pulling the switch
right
here. And you have to look at this as a series of pieces, and you know, or a list of boxes that are being checked off. And you know, two of the biggest boxes were a deal with the UAW and a deal with the debt holders at Chrysler. And we've pretty much got all the other ducks in a row. There's one duck flying around, which is the debt holders. And that's the deal that they'll try to get this week before the Thursday deadline.
Mickey, I mean, I'm looking at this. It's a government sort of, you know, push to get Fiat and Chrysler to make a deal. I mean, in normal circumstances, wouldn't we call this a liquidation? That basically,
well,
Fiat is liquidating Chrysler to Fiat.
It's a very interesting situation because, you know, for all that we talk about Buy America, and essentially the Obama administration is allowing an Italian company to take over an American company. And I was just thinking back to a couple of years ago when Daimler Chrysler put Chrysler up for sale, and there was a line of investment banks and others who wanted a piece of the company,
right,
and Cerberus
right.
Capital Management got out in front. And here is Cerberus essentially just saying to the government, you take it, you get rid of it.
Let's move to GM now. There is expected to be an announcement giving some details of this restructuring. There's a June 1st deadline on restructuring. Is it likely that GM will actually announce today that they're killing Pontiac?
Yes, actually, that is one of the steps that they're planning to take. And, you know, General Motors has had, I think it's three chances in the last four months to write a business plan that could win it federal assistance. The first time was actually back in December. And we have a story in today's Times that looks at how their sales forecast has sort of changed every single time they write a business plan. So back in February, they said they would make Pontiac something called a focused niche brand, which would mean that the dealerships would stay and they'd have a few models, but they'd be folded in with Buick and GMC. Now, apparently, GM is going to say we're getting rid of Pontiac altogether. But, you know, there are a lot of people that think GM could get along with two brands, Cadillac and Chevrolet, because Toyota has essentially two brands. So does Honda. So does Nissan.
Well, there is a city in Michigan named Cadillac. They're probably feeling all right today. But the people who live in Pontiac, Michigan, who knows about them? Perhaps an assignment from the New York Times national desk. Micheline Maynard, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Mickey Maynard is a New York Times senior business correspondent joining us from Detroit.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. World markets are one thing, reacting to swine flu, the outbreak in Mexico City. But what do you think? Terry emails us, are the masks that you can buy at the pharmacy useful in preventing transmission of flu? My understanding is that viruses can pass through the holes so you can breathe. The CDC says if used correctly, face masks and respirators can help prevent some exposures, but they should be used along with other preventive measures such as avoiding close contact and maintaining good hand hygiene. Responsible vigilance regarding the swine flu story that we're following all morning at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Okay has some headlines now.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Don't travel to the US and Mexico unless you have to, is the message coming from the EU Health Commissioner today.
Personally, I would try to avoid non-essential travel to the areas which are reported to be in the center of the cluster in order to minimize the personal risk and to reduce the potential risk to spread the infection to other people.
Meanwhile, the CDC has launched what it calls passive border screening for swine flu exposure. The agency says that U.S. border officials will be asking people about fever and illness and looking for people who are ill. There are 20 reported cases of the swine flu in the United States. Meanwhile, Asian investors sent airline stocks tumbling today as the EU asked Europeans to avoid non-essential travel to Mexico and the US, as you just heard. The outbreak began in Mexico, where it sickened 1,600 people. Hong Kong's flagship carrier Cathay Pacific dropped 8%, while Australia's Qantas Airlines went down 4%. And stocks for several drug companies soared, possibly in anticipation of increased demand. Internationally, Iraq says that a raid by US soldiers yesterday in southern Iraq violated a security pact between Iraq and the US. It's the most recent of several violent episodes that have caused public protests since the agreement took effect in January. The US military says the raid had been approved by the Iraqi government. And the youngest son of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has begun an apprenticeship in the National Defense Commission, which is the country's most powerful governing agency. And that's according to a South Korean news report. Kim Jong-un is considered by many analysts to be a likely successor to his father. That's a look at news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
100 days, 100 nights, and no one man's
good morning, everyone. Our Monday agenda segment is here. And of course, the first milestone on the calendar this week is on Wednesday. President Obama will mark the end of his first 100 days in office. A real milestone or a false one? It is likely to be a week that will test the president in a variety of ways. Already this 100 days has tested the new administration. Hear me to talk about the tests and what this week is going to be like and whether, as Robert Gibbs says, the 100 days is more of a Hallmark holiday than something real is Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times. First of all, Marcus, it does appear that the swine flu concern is a real test of the administration's preparedness and ability to respond on something so psychologically electric here.
I think that's right, John. I think it's interesting that we saw yesterday the declaration of the weekend, rather the emergency, a healthcare emergency in the U.S., which, as Femi was saying in the news segment, allows us to unleash emergency preparedness methods, including the shipping of millions of doses of antivirals. That's a key part of this. The WHO, the World Health Organization, which is will kind of do a global alert, is in charge of that. Right now we're in a phase three, which means there's localized, some spreading from animals to humans of what is, after all, an animal infection. They will be announcing tomorrow whether we're going to phase four or five, which is, again, about the size of clusters, as they call them, of those infected. So that's both the number of people infected as well as the geographic spread of those infected that will decide whether we go to four or five.
Now, you have a lot of insight as to how Washington works. And as someone with your perspective, how do we tell the difference as listeners and viewers between the bureaucracy just sort of working its various cogs mm-hmm. and wheels versus something that's really being managed from the White House by Barack Obama?
Well, you know, what we can do is we can watch where the pronouncements come from. If they're coming from the CDC, or if they're coming from the White House. Ironically, if they're coming from the CDC, I think for the most part that means bureaucracy is working. That means the White House is not stepping in where it shouldn't be. The worst thing the White House can do in this case, and sometimes it's to the White House's disfavor if you don't act fast enough, and we saw it starting with Katrina and the Bush administration, but usually when a White House is letting the agencies, as it were, direct a policy like this and make the pronouncements, that's actually a better sign. That the president is not in panic mode and that the administration actually is in control of it. So far, they get pretty high marked for what they're doing. Hmm.
Let's talk about the 100 days. They sort of downplay it once, you know, and then the next day they upplay it. You know, there's going to be a news conference on Wednesday. It seems to me that they consider that this 100-day milestone has some significance, maybe if just to get it over with. What do you think?
Well, it's really ironic because they start off, as you said, you know, with Gibbs talking about Hallmark holiday, meaning one really for the card manufacturers, not a real holiday. Well, I think Mother's Day started off as a Hallmark holiday, and who would say that that's not a holiday?
Yeah, there you
anymore.
Go.
So Hallmark holidays.
Manufactured holidays, a good business.
Absolutely. There Valentine's you Day, anyone? You know. So I think, in fact, it does mean something just because the import that that we in the media are going to put on it, and you have nothing to do but look at the 24-hour cable news stations, and it's going to be a great import that we will put on it. And ironically, the administration in the end, by trying to get together this budget reconciliation deal, they actually themselves are paying a great deal of importance on it because they have now given it importance, meaning basically if the leadership of the Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate come up with a budget deal and also an agreement to push through on a fast track things like health care reform, most importantly, as part of that budget deal, in order to do that, you have to get some conservative Democrats on board who weren't really comfortable with a fast-track health care mandate change. change, but that's probably going to happen. If they can do that by the 100th day, then that does mean something. That means they have a political weight in Capitol Hill that's pretty remarkable.
So to get this budget number, and you believe they're going to have a number, a reconciliation number, by the end of the week?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do. Well, they want to have it actually before the 100th day.
Before the 100th day.
So, I don't know if they'll reach that, but I think they're going to come close.
So to get that, they've had to put cap and trade on the back seat. That's off the table right now.
Absolutely. That will not be on the fast track.
And health care is on the fast track, but without the GOP, it seems, at this point.
And that's what's extraordinary. With this reconciliation process, you can do basically impose a deadline by October 15th, saying if the Republicans, in the regular process of bipartisanship dealing in the Congress as called by the Constitution, do not have a deal with the Democrats by October 15th, which is also the budget deadline, then you go ahead and make a deal that can pass with only 51 votes in the Senate rather than 60.
Wow, so that gets out of the cloture problem in the Senate. Yep. Let's talk about two other stories. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court is going to hear final arguments in the extension of the Voting Rights Act case. What's the significance?
This is much more serious than the 100-day hoopla that we're going to hear a lot about in the next few days, and where there's report cards and up and down. And this is actually is very meaningful. This is Section 5. The Supreme Court is reviewing on the last day of the session, this court session, they're reviewing Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, this section has been authorized by Congress every 5 years and then 25 years for the last time it was authorized, but now it's being challenged by a utility district in Texas. Under Section 5, jurisdictions with a history of discrimination, particularly racial segregation, particularly against African Americans, those districts have to come and get preclearance from the Department of Justice before they make any changes at all in the way they hold elections, whether that's moving a polling station or whether that's redistricting. Now, this district in Austin did not exist back when that was first decided. And so their argument is, we don't have a history of voting rights irregularities because we didn't exist until the 80s. So therefore, as a utility district, we make you vote in Texas.
Right.
So therefore, we should not be covered by it. If the court were to rule broadly in this case, it could undo all of the Section 5s and all the coverage jurisdictions, which for the most part are in the South, although there are some here in New York State, for instance, and in other states as well.
Very high stakes. And one other thing, we don't have time to talk about it, but Chuck Schumer, the senior senator from New York, is going to maybe flex some muscle by introducing a bill on corporate governance in the middle of all the economic downturn crisis details. So Marcus Mabry, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partners, The New York Times, and that's your agenda this morning. The swine flu has got the world on edge. A lot more we don't know. We'll continuously update you throughout the morning. We'll have experts and reporters on throughout the day to answer your questions. And here's one.
Chet Forster from Detroit, Michigan. Scheduled a flight to Cancun Airport for a vacation in the Riviera Maya on May 6th for a week. Of course, decline the travel insurance. Being the case on what's going on in Mexico City, any thoughts on canceling my travel plans?
That's a tough one. The CDC hasn't made any travel restrictions, so really, unfortunately, it's up to you at this point. But in case you're worried, some airlines are letting you change your reservation. American Airlines says it will waive its usual penalty for changing reservations for anyone traveling to, from, or through Mexico from now until May 6th. Check with your airline. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with more questions or email anything posted at mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed any of our coverage on the swine flu, and it is an outbreak, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Sorting the numbers in Mexico City.
There are many cases, mild cases, that have been seen like just a normal respiratory disease, and they have had, in fact, influenza.
Doctors in Mexico City looking at swine flu fatalities try to manage a health crisis as Mexican officials move to consider shutting down the densest city in the world. Backpedaling in a traveling 6 billion person world. Do the math on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, April 27th. I'm John Hockenberry. It's just an outbreak of swine flu at this moment, and it seems to be mostly confined to Mexico, but there are outbreaks around the world. We'll have all the latest details and also talk about a new frontline documentary that looks into what happens to mentally ill prison inmates after they're released. A look ahead to today's major economies forum in Washington, which may forecast negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol later this year. Remember that? Those stories, but first, these headlines. Automaker General Motors is releasing its new restructuring plan. The company will cut 21,000 additional factory jobs and phase out its Pontiac brand. Detroit auto analyst John McElroy says the move was probably pushed through by the federal government.
It would seem this indicates that the Treasury, and more specifically the Presidential Task Force, is really in control here. All along, General Motors has said it really never wanted to drop Pontiac.
The automaker also says it will offer 225 shares of common stock for every $1,000 held by bondholders as part of a so-called debt-for-equity swap. The announcement came in a filing today with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The U.S. has declared a public health emergency. Now, that sounds draconian, but it's in fact a preparatory measure to deal with an outbreak of swine flu. Right now, there are 20 reported cases. Richard Besser, doctor, acting director of the Centers for Disease Control, says he expects the number of sick Americans to rise.
Given the reports out of Mexico, I would expect that over time we're going to see more severe disease in this country.
As we mentioned, the outbreak began in Mexico, where the virus has sickened 1,600 people and killed perhaps more than 100. Femi Okay is here to help me out on a busy Monday morning. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, John. We were talking about the World Bank. The World Bank says that it is urging wealthy countries to provide help to poorer nations. President Robert Zoellick announced a series of initiatives at the group's spring meeting this weekend.
Other initiatives include support for microfinance to help poor borrowers, a global trade finance program, and a capitalization fund for developing country banks.
Many of the infrastructure initiatives focus on Africa. The World Bank says that it's especially at risk as government budgets fall short across the continent. Sri Lanka's 25-year-long civil war may be coming to an end. The government said today that it would stop using heavy weapons and airstrikes against an embattled band of Tamil Tiger rebels. The army is planning to rescue civilians trapped there instead. John.
That's a positive story. The Dow and S&P went up more than 1% on Friday, but it looks like a negative opening this morning. Market concerns about the swine flu outbreak in Mexico City and elsewhere around the world are causing Asian markets to decline, and the futures trading suggests a negative opening on Wall Street. What questions do you have about steps you should take, not as an investor, but as a citizen worried about the swine flu? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We'll put those questions to our experts all hour.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. All morning long, the numbers have stayed pretty steady. I'll repeat them now, but they are likely to rise as more health professionals weigh in later today. An outbreak of swine flu in Mexico City, first reported in Mexico City, has apparently killed 103 people in that city, although it's believed only 22 or so are actually confirmed to this specific strain of the virus. More than 1,600 people are believed to have contracted the swine flu virus in Mexico City, and around the world there are other cases. As far as New Zealand and other places around the world, 20 confirmed cases here in the United States, 5 states, California to New York, Ohio and Texas. It's an outbreak at this point in all of those places concerned. It's not an epidemic even in Mexico, and it's too early to call it a pandemic, which is, of course, the worst case scenario and the early fear of people like Lori Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and writer of two best-selling books, one of which is called The Coming Plague. She's now a senior fellow for global health issues with the Council on Foreign Relations. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
I imagine you spent all of your weekend answering questions of friends and also colleagues. Is this the big one? How did you answer them?
Well, I said it's too soon to tell. We don't know what the denominator is, which is to say,
in Mexico, we don't know really how many people have been infected and not taken seriously ill and not died. So we don't know. Is it 103 deaths out of 2,000? That would be terrible. Is it 103 deaths out of 10 million? Well, it's sad for each family, but it's not terrible for a pandemic. So we still have big black boxes.
And part of the concern here, and this is something that I know you cover a lot, is the difficulty in assembling quality information at this stage of an outbreak like this. The reporting infrastructure is either not great or is just too complex a problem. Which do you think it is?
Well, it's a little of both. Actually, the Mexican public health system is pretty darn good, and they do better than the United States on a lot of public health things such as child vaccination. I know a lot of Americans are prone to think of Mexico as a second-class country, a poor country, but in fact they have an excellent public health infrastructure and better access to health care for Mexicans than we have in the United States for Americans. That said, the problem they have now is that is having rapid diagnostics for influenza, and specifically a very rapid way to diagnose who has this particular strain versus any other type of flu or other illnesses that cause similar symptoms. And we would have the same problem in the United States. This is not an easy thing to do. Any fever, any sort of nausea, feeling lousy, weak, fatigue, muscle aches, well, that's pretty much how a wide range of diseases and infections start, with the same set of symptoms.
And is it the case that to figure out if it's actually this strain, you have to send something, a blood test or something, to Atlanta? That's really the infrastructure in the U.S.?
That is indeed the infrastructure in the U.S., Atlanta and a handful of other labs. And in fact, Mexico sent some of their early samples all the way up to Winnipeg, Canada, to a high-security laboratory there.
So Keith Bradshaw, also joining us now, Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. The infrastructure in Hong Kong, with more recent experience with avian flu and SARS, is better prepared to do the notification. Any sort of indication that the reporting job on the front lines in Hong Kong has unearthed any cases that might be relevant here?
So far, there are no confirmed cases in Hong Kong whatsoever. The city has been terrified of the possibility of some kind of a large outbreak of disease ever since SARS in 2003 and the bird flu fears, as you mentioned, in 2004 and 2005. So it's very well equipped for this sort of thing. It will have not one but six different local public hospitals in the city all up and running doing tests very quickly by this Thursday. They did test two people today, both of whom were negative, who had one of a 77-year-old woman, a grandmother, who'd been to Mexico and back and was immediately tested, found negative. Her 4-year-old daughter, who'd been exposed to her, also negative. And there's one possible. To give you an idea of how thorough the Hong Kong authorities are, they quarantined someone in a hospital because they had come through San Francisco, where there are no confirmed cases in that city, specifically in California, yet. But they quarantined someone for having signs of any respiratory distress and for having gone through San Francisco, and that person is still being tested at the hospital.
Now, does that sense of precaution and unilateral quarantines in Hong Kong make people feel better, or is it really a case where fears on the part of the population based on these experiences you've described cause governments to do things that could have, you know, bad political implications down the line?
That's a tricky one. In Hong Kong, the government is very much inclined to err on the side of being too cautious. The predecessor for the current health minister here in Hong Kong lost his job for not being aggressive enough in responding to SARS in 2003. The government was nearly toppled by very large street demonstrations after SARS that were partly in response to SARS, also in response to some other issues. But there has been a general strong demand from the population here. Never again do people want to end up in wearing face masks in empty streets. Now, it might happen again. It's hard to avoid it in the case of flu, but there's a tendency to err on the side of caution here.
Well, Laurie Garrett, Keith Bradshaw describes that for its own survival reasons, the government is erring on the side of caution. Is that a good public health strategy as well?
Well, I think everybody should pay attention to Hong Kong because when I was there during the SARS epidemic, Hong Kong was on a steep and rapid learning curve. They've made a lot of changes in Hong Kong that Well, I do think a lot of other countries, including the United States, would do well to learn from the changes that Hong Kong has made, including building more isolation ventilation rooms for people with contagious infections. We don't have such rooms in most hospitals in most of the United States right now.
So can I ask you a couple of sort of down-home listener questions, Laurie?
Sure.
Jeremy in Detroit asks, what impact do the huge amount of antibiotics being fed to our livestock have in the crossing of these illnesses over to human beings?
Zero for viruses, but a great deal for bacterial infections. And we now have ample evidence that abuse of antibiotics as growth promoters in the livestock industry, not just in pigs, but also in chickens, aquaculture for farmed fish and so on, is indeed promoting drug-resistant bacterial infections that are indeed transmissible to humans.
What about viruses? Anything about our human-animal interactions in the food chain, et cetera, that could be a vector for virus transmission?
Well, indirectly. I mean, one of the things that's going on with all aspects of livestock production is concentrating it into larger and larger and larger production centers and dispersing different segments of the slaughter process so that, for example, when E. coli 0157 emerged, the jack-in-the-box infection, as it was called at the time, we couldn't track down exactly what cow and what ranch it came from because all hamburger is pooled into giant centers where it's all ground together. So when you eat a hamburger, you're eating bits of maybe 20, 50, 200 different cows. It makes it really hard to track things, and it also means that workers who are on these giant pig farms that are really pork factories are exposed to thousands and thousands of pigs every day. So you have to just get out of your mind the notion of the small family farmer with six oinkers running right around with 25 cluckers. That's not what we're dealing with here.
All right, a quick question I want to end with, Keith. Laurie, can I eat pork? A bunch of listeners have asked that question.
Yes, well, I mean, you may have other issues with pork, but
right,
as far as flu goes, no problem.
Laurie Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist and writer of two best-selling books, including The Coming Plague. She's a senior fellow for global health issues for the Council on Foreign Relations. Keith Bradshaw, before we go, what changes in the food chain did they make in Asia to deal with the same kinds of concerns that Laurie is talking about there of transmission cross species?
They have made some changes here towards trying to consolidate production into fewer farms. Here the issue has been, as Laurie so put it so well, the six oinkers and 25 cluckers living in the house with the farmer in large areas of Asia, and that's still an issue. In Hong Kong, there is now extensive surveillance and monitoring of the health of the livestock populations. But Hong Kong is the exception. I remember going down to Vietnam 2004 and 2005, and seeing a couple of pilot projects to try to introduce somewhat larger farms where you had the animals fenced off from the people and so forth, but then you get miles after mile of farms on the way to and from it where you still have livestock in close proximity to people and potentially mingling viruses.
Object lessons from Asia as we focus on what's going on in Mexico City with the swine flu outbreak, also in the United States. Keith Bradshaw, Hong Kong Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. A couple of things we should let you know about. There are actual school closings in the United States in Queens because of swine flu, suspected swine flu cases, also in Fair Oaks near Sacramento, and at the Schertz-Cibolo Universal Independent School District in San Antonio, Texas. Just an indication of early steps being taken.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A reminder, we're following the developing story of the swine flu outbreak in Mexico and the incidences and outbreaks that are occurring around the world, including here in the United States. We'll keep you fully up to date on that. And any questions that you may have, we will put to our guests in the course of the program this morning at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. So in the United States, in the prison system, we like to think of prisons as having something to do with rehabilitation or doing something to care for the people who are inmates in those prisons. It's an idea that's been around for a long time. We don't like to think of the prison system as simply a warehouse for individuals we don't want on the street. But for the mentally ill who go into prisons for reasons that are questionable and who come out of prisons that are equally for reasons that are equally questionable, warehousing might just be a good name. 5 years ago, in the Frontline documentary The New Asylums, filmmakers Karen O'Connor and Mary Novaski documented how the Ohio prison system struggled to provide care, real care, to thousands of mentally ill inmates. To answer the question of what happens when those inmates are released into the community, Karen O'Connor has another film called The Released, a Frontline co-production with Mead Street Films. It airs tomorrow night. Frontline is a WGBH production from Boston. WGBH is our partner. Karen O'Connor joins us from Western Massachusetts. Karen, thanks for being on the program.
Pleasure to be with you, John. Thank you.
How alarming and how challenging is the question of what to do with mentally ill inmates when their sentences are up and they're released into the community?
It's pretty alarming. This year alone in the United States, there'll be over 700,000 prisoners coming out back into the communities. And it's the largest exodus actually in U.S. history. And half of those will be mentally ill. So it's probably an issue that's more pressing than ever.
Now, when you say mentally ill, are we talking about people who are depressed or have, you know, what we might describe as attitude problems or something more severe?
Something more severe. Our film in particular, we're looking at the seriously mentally ill, the severely mentally ill, and in most cases in our film, all of the inmates have been diagnosed with what's been described as paranoid schizophrenia. So this is real mental illness, severe psychiatric disorders.
Well, listen to this excerpt from your film about an inmate who you encountered by the name of Stokes, and I'm wondering if his situation is typical. Listen, and I'll ask you when we come back.
I have psychotic episodes sometimes when I'm not taking the medication. I could be a real jerk. I take Clozaril. It's an antipsychotic. It's like a miracle drug. I'm a totally different person on it. I mean, I'm able to function, abide by rules set here and everything, and it's the medication that I need to be on.
He needs to be on this medication, Karen O'Connor, but is Stokes likely to have his compliance monitored in any sense once he's out of prison?
Oh, that's the central issue, John. It's the real failure, actually. No, once he walks out of the prison gate, staying on his medication will be voluntary. And unfortunately, with schizophrenia, insight into one's own illness is often lacking, at least when unmedicated. So it has been a real problem for Stokes and for nearly every severely mentally ill person who leaves prison. Unending problem.
To even maintain their prescription drugs that, as you say and point out in the film, are absolutely critical to people maintaining their sanity or their ability to function, maintaining their prescription drugs involves what sort of interaction with healthcare agencies and government agencies to even make sure that they can have the pills on hand?
Well, that's the point. I mean, navigating our healthcare system is difficult for any of us, never mind if you come out of prison after however many years and have a serious mental illness. In the film, there's this wonderful psychiatrist who works with an outreach team. There's a mobile van in Columbus that's trying to bring psychiatric treatment to the homeless and to those living under bridges and in cardboard boxes who are, many of them, recently released from prison. And he talks about the realities of psychiatric treatment for those coming out of incarceration is virtually non-existent, and that it isn't a population that's going to be able to, one, navigate that mental health system, and even if they can, they're not people who are going to come to him with their planners and their organizers and their Blackberries and be easily compliant when they're living behind a dumpster somewhere. So it's always difficult, but it's especially difficult for ex-offenders with serious mental illness.
Now, you describe the scale of this problem as a huge exodus from prison, the largest, I believe you said, in U.S. history, or certainly in recent memory, of mentally ill going out into the community. And as you describe in the film, with very few institutions monitoring their behavior, I gather you began with the premise that this is something we should all be alarmed about. But in observing your film, one acquires an enormous amount of sympathy and real sadness for the victims here. It's not us who are the victims. It's these inmates.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say it. It's what we attempted to do, actually, is to just go in with, to provide at least some intimate look at the lives of these people with serious mental illness, and to see why it's a struggle to remain free. What's really shocking is how often these same guys go in and out, and just this revolving door between jail, prison, streets, and back again. And so for us, just following these individuals over the course of time, you realize that none of us should be surprised that it is really virtually impossible for the seriously mentally ill to stay out of prison these days.
But if you could follow them, it at least suggests that mental health professionals, if there was an infrastructure in place, could monitor their compliance and make sure that they were healthy and safe out in communities, right?
Yeah, I think that's what we discovered, is it's the issue feels so vast. At the same time, the answer seems relatively simple. They need a decent place to live, they need somebody keeping an eye on them, and they need to stay medicated. And so that seems doable. It's certainly within reach anyway.
Well, they're called The Released. They're the subject of filmmaker Karen O'Connor's new film, The Released, a Frontline co-production with Mead Street Films, which airs tomorrow night, about what happens to mentally ill inmates when they leave prison. Check your local PBS listing station for listings. Karen, thanks for joining us. And now Femi Oke has got the headlines.
At 29 minutes past the hour, GM has just released its plans to restructure the company. GM will cut 21,000 hourly jobs and close down Pontiac lines completely as part of a deal to get more federal aid. The plan also includes a debt-for-equity deal with creditors. The White House is hoping that Chrysler can avoid a bankruptcy filing. Economic adviser Larry Summers says that the administration will do its part to help Chrysler secure a deal with the Italian automaker Fiat. And in the United States, regulators shut down four more banks this weekend, raising the number of failed banks to 29 so far this year. And that's more banks than failed all of 2008. The banks seized on Friday were American Southern Bank in Georgia, Michigan Heritage Bank, the First Bank of Idaho, and the First Bank of Beverly Hills in California.
Wow. Thanks, Emmy.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So you've all been reacting to the swine flu story this morning. The markets are reacting. Wall Street just opened, and the Dow and Joe's Industrial Average is down about 1% on jitters that the swine flu may have an impact on business around the world. But again, it's early in the market day. Natalie emails us with actually some answers. I just returned last night from visiting my parents in Mexico, and I don't want to make less the seriousness of the swine flu, but I think it's important not to cause a pandemic. Basic precautions you can take to prevent this and most other airborne diseases are: wash your hands frequently, sneeze into a tissue or into the crook of your shoulder, not your hand, and if cases are reported in your city, avoid crowded places. Call us with your swine flu questions and concerns at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to have some travel concerns later on in the program that we will address directly. If you're like me, you probably like to conflate a lot of these stories about pandemics and epidemics and swine flu with climate change. The world is warming up, and that has all kinds of implications for bugs. Well, today, 17 governments will begin meeting at the Major Economies Forum in Washington to talk about the Kyoto Protocols and whether climate change policy is something that can be pursued in a global manner with the United States in the tent as opposed to outside the tent during the Bush administration. Join us to talk about the Kyoto Protocol is Andrew Revkin, New York Times climate change reporter. And Andrew, I mean, is it wrong of me to think that with stories like epidemics, in this case, we're just talking about the outbreak of the swine flu in Mexico, severe weather, diseases, you know, the climate change is really behind the scenes at work in all these things?
No, it's wrong.
I should not worry about this.
Well, it depends on your time scale. We live at a time when climate change, the changes that could come and are starting to emerge, according to most scientists, from the human impact on the climate are going to take generations still to unfold in a way where you could sort of point to some particular extreme, whatever, you name it, cold spell, hot spell, and say, aha, that's us.
What about human mobility?
Well, that's the reality is we live at a one-time spike in our numbers. In 1830, there were only 1 billion people on planet Earth. Now there are a billion teenagers on planet Earth. There's close to 7 billion, and we're heading toward 9, more or less, 9 billion people. And we're urbanizing at the same time. We've just become a mainly urban species for the first time in our history. And, of course, mobility is unprecedented. So things that happened in 1918 can happen now in a month in terms of getting – if there's some particularly nasty pathogen out there that likes to hitch rides, it can be around the world in a matter of hours.
Literally. And in 1918, you're referring to the flu pandemic, of course, which killed 100,000 around the world when it
million, 100 million,
around,
yeah,
100
yeah,
million around yeah. the world. It hitched rides, you know, all over, and we didn't have the global mobility that we have now. But let's talk about Kyoto then for a moment. With climate change on an upward trend, global warming is understood to be, you know, trending upward by all of the industrialized nations. What are the political dynamics as these 17 governments begin meeting in preparation for some sort of real protocol? Is it all about China and the United States?
Yes.
Yes.
The two gorillas in the greenhouse are these two extraordinary countries. One is still quite poor. When you know, we look at China from here and we see this emerging powerhouse economically, but still, in terms of per capita income, it's a fraction of our income and a fraction of our emissions of these greenhouse gases, which come from burning fossil fuels. And so in China, there's a very strong sense still that it's our obligation, having spent 200 years getting rich burning fossil fuels, to step first on this route towards some new agreement.
Now, that was a very politically inflammatory disagreement that caused the Bush administration to back away, you know, saying we're not going to just destroy our economic development for this silly Kyoto climate protocol. The situation has changed significantly now, and we're in the middle of an economic downturn.
Yeah, although the actual dynamics that led to the Bush administration rejecting it haven't changed at all. The problem is President Obama, as with Bush and as with Clinton, they have to deal with the Senate. Any new treaty has to get approval of two-thirds of the Senate. So it's that's a big number of senators to have on board. And the Senate since 1997 has said affirmatively, repeatedly, that any treaty that doesn't include concrete obligations, commitments from China and the other large developing countries is a non-starter.
So essentially China and the rest of the 17 governments are speaking to Richard Shelby in the Senate?
In a way you have this weird dynamic where so there's a shackle on the president's leg saying anything you do. And actually, Todd Stern, the president's climate envoy, essentially said this. You know, we have to have a treaty this time that we know is adoptable here. We're not going to make the mistake that was made in 1997 of Kyoto, where we have a rush to an agreement that we know will never pass muster at home. And that, so there you have this
pragmatism.
Real tough, but it's a real tough situation, right. Basically.
So is it possible that as the 17 governments sit down, that the world economy has actually done them all a favor and that the global downturn actually has a positive impact on carbon emissions, on global warming, that the recession is going to do what none of these world leaders has the will to do on their own?
It's pretty clear. I just was listening to the radio this morning on the way in, and there's a 30% drop in what we send to landfills right now. So that means guaranteed emissions of the greenhouse gases have slowed as well. And this could either be seen as an opportunity, but it also can be a bigger problem for two reasons. One is, you know, we're consumed with other things right now, rebuilding the economy. In places like China, they've talked about having a green aspect to their rebuild of their economy, as we have. But the imperative is still about growing the economy. And then,
but is there a green dimension to growing the economy that can actually be put into policy on both the Chinese side and the U.S. side?
More so here. We have the wealth and the technology to build a cleaner power plant than one that might otherwise be built. In China, they're still saying, if you want us to build a cleaner power plant, we're very happy to do so if you help us pay for it.
If you help us pay for it.
Yeah, and so how do you get the Senate again or Congress generally on board at a time of economic trouble? Now, and again, with the issue sort of on a back burner, and the polling shows that, you know, the average person now, this is so far off.
So far down, right?
It never was a high priority, and now it's far down the list. Today, this morning, Obama is giving a speech at the National Academy of Sciences on the importance of invigorating our scientific enterprise. That's a vital aspect of whatever happens in this world if we're going to respond effectively to climate. So we'll see what comes from that, too.
And the president has been speaking to the American Academy. The recession is possibly a green opportunity, and it's going to be discussed by the 17 governments who begin meeting at the Major Economies Forum in Washington. That happens today. Andrew Revkin, New York Times environmental reporter specializing in climate change, thanks so much for joining us. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thank you very much. At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, going straight to the National Academy of Science, where, as John says, the president was speaking there this morning. He says that the declaration of a public health emergency in the wake of the spreading swine flu is a precautionary measure.
We are closely monitoring the emerging cases of swine flu in the United States. And this is obviously a cause for concern and requires a heightened state of alert. But it's not a cause for alarm.
So far, 20 cases of swine flu have been found in the United States. Meanwhile, in Mexico, the swine flu is suspected of killing at least 100 people. In Detroit, GM has just released its plans to restructure the company. It will cut 21,000 hourly jobs and close down Pontiac lines completely as part of a deal to get more federal aid. Let's look at the two big stories of this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And now we have a chance to put some of your questions that we've been getting all morning reacting to the outbreak of swine flu in Mexico City and outbreaks that have also been reported all around the world. Joining us is Rudy Maxa, host and executive producer of the PBS travel series Rudy Maxa's World. Rudy, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, John. Thanks.
I suspect you're not surprised that most of the questions come from travelers, people sitting looking at their tickets, either traveling to or through Mexico, wondering what they should do. It's not a surprise, right?
No, not a surprise at all. We certainly saw that several years ago with the outbreak of bird flu in Asia.
Right, and SARS as well. Darren emailed us, I'm supposed to go to Lima, Peru tonight and then on to Santiago on Thursday, both for work. He's got a pretty narrow time horizon. Should I cancel the trip, Rudy?
I don't think you should cancel it. No, there have been no significant cases in Peru that I know of, and you know, I think we have to put this in perspective. As medical professionals just said, in fact, on your show a few minutes ago, this is some warnings or a precautionary measure as opposed to an emergency. I mean, look at Mexico City. This is a city with, you know, 18.5 million people for population. The odds of you changing planes in Mexico City or going there on a business or leisure trip and contracting swine flu have to be infinitesimal. I mean, you know, maybe you'll win the Powerball lottery before that. So I don't make light of this. I'm just saying that the news is scary, the disease is scary, the potential is scary, but I'm also reminded, I was just doing some searches of clips, and I noticed that back in the early 2000s, a medical specialist was saying that between 5 million and 150 million people may be killed in the course of the SARS epidemic. Well, of course, the numbers barely reached, four figures. So there is a little bit of, I call it sort of a mistake of the central position, the thought that you of all people in a city of 18 million people will come down with the flu is, I think, is greatly exaggerating your position in the world.
Right. Well, I suspect you would say, and Darren goes on to say, that he actually has Tamiflu, the antiviral drug, and he wants to know if he should wear a mask on the plane. Quickly, you would say that those are going way overboard, right?
Well, I can't advise on Tamiflu. I'm, as they say, not a doctor. And you know what? Look, if you are really, afraid of this and are a germaphobe, I mean, none of us want to get germs, but they're all around us all the time, of course, go ahead and wear a mask. If it makes you feel better, what the heck? I mean, this is the basic stuff. Cover your nose and mouth with a tissue when you cough or sneeze. Throw out that tissue when you use it. Wash your hands with soap and water often. Try to avoid close contact with sick people. And if you get sick with flu, stay away from other people and go see a doctor. That's the basic advice from the California Department of Public Health, and it's good advice worldwide.
What's the travel industry doing to deal with people who are coming here from other places, either to reassure them or to take precautions, Rudy?
I don't think they're doing anything yet, at least in the United States. However, countries like Indonesia and Japan, and I'm guessing China, because even when there wasn't an outbreak of flu, China does this, as you enter the country through airports, there are often detectors that will, as you literally walk through them, and it's not a line like you do for security. You just walk through them as you're coming from the luggage carousel, and they will detect if you have an unusually high temperature. And if they detect that, you'll be pulled aside and questioned.
Rudy, last second, are cruise ships still going to Mexico?
They are, yes.
They are. All right. So Debbie is going to feel very good. She has a honeymoon trip booked for her son, and that can still go ahead. Thank you, Rudy Maxa, host and executive producer of Rudy Maxa's World, PBS series on travel. Thanks, Rudy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, the human fear of bugs, pandemics down through history in a moment. But first, real headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama says that the emerging case of swine flu are cause for concern, but not cause for alarm.
The Department of Health and Human Services has declared a public health emergency as a precautionary tool to ensure that we have the resources we need at our disposal to respond quickly and effectively.
Border agents are stepping up health screenings to try to identify people who may be infected. So far, 20 cases of swine flu have been identified in the United States. The European Union Health Commissioner Androula Vassiliou is updating her advice to Europeans planning to travel to the US and Mexico.
Personally, I would try to avoid non-essential travel to the areas which are reported to be in the center of the cluster, in order to minimize the personal risk and to reduce the potential risk to spread the infection to other people.
Now, in spite of the commissioner's comments, there's been no formal advice to travelers from the European Union. Automaker General Motors is releasing its new restructuring plan. The company will cut 21,000 factory jobs and phase out its Pontiac brand. The automaker also says that it will offer 225 shares of common stock for every $1,000 held by bondholders as part of a debt for equity swap, And the announcement came in a filing today with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And right now the company is living on government loans and must restructure by June the 1st in order to avoid declaring bankruptcy. Let's look at the big stories for this morning, John.
Thank you, Femi. So the outbreak of swine flu causing concern from Mexico to New Zealand certainly isn't the first epidemic in history to spur widespread worry. As you know, in the past, at least we had good news to go along with the panic. In November 1918, the city of San Francisco was worried about the influenza pandemic sweeping the globe, even as it was celebrating a party to celebrate the end of World War I.
The war is over. Into Market Street for the men and women of the city to celebrate. Up and down the street they parade, delirious with joy. For some of them have come to know the meaning of war. Grotesque and ugly in their influenza masks, the people of San Francisco celebrate.
World War I was over, but the influenza was still there. Joining us to talk about the sort of history and fear and mythology of epidemics like this and moments like these is Phil Alcabas, professor of urban public health at Hunter College of the City of New York and author of the forthcoming Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian Flu. He's in the studio with us. Thank you, Professor.
Nice to be here.
There is a lot psychologically that drives populations at moments like this when the numbers are small, but the history is so disturbing.
It's impossible not to be afraid where we've got fear built into us, and naturally so. What I'm pleased about with respect to at least the last few days of dealing with this new problem is that the response on the part of authorities has been pretty uniformly measured. And in fact, we've heard from New York City's health commissioner, from federal officials, don't panic.
And, you know, don't panic is a good suggestion, but it's also, you know, it takes a while to know what's going on here. I mean, in 3 days, things can rise exponentially. You don't want to panic, but you do want to take steps, and already people are putting on masks. Is that appropriate?
Well, information's good, and we don't have all the information we need yet. And it's just impossible to get all the information because this is too new. Masks, well, as your clip from San Francisco in 1918 mentioned, masks probably don't hurt, and there's a little bit of evidence that they may have helped in the past.
And certainly we're seeing pictures of people in Mexico wearing masks, and, you know, I guess if it makes you feel good, do it. But if it causes other people to panic, maybe government should, you know, weigh in and suggest a better course. Let's talk about the flu itself. Every year, a lot of people die of flu, right?
Yes. Flu produces an epidemic. We call it seasonal flu. In this part of the world, it's every winter. Comes around in November, and it's usually gone by this time of year. The situation in Mexico is a little bit late compared to usual.
Now, it's my understanding that more people than 103 die of flu every year in its normal seasonal occurrence. How many?
Those numbers are, first of all, they vary from year to year, and it's hard to gauge because it's not always clear when people die from influenza itself or when they die from complications.
Complications, I see.
But there are thousands of deaths
thousands,
the U.S. every
right,
year.
Thousands, just in the U.S.
Right,
every year.
Right.
Is flu the most concerning disease because of the death toll of 1918 or because it's so infectious and moves so quickly?
It's a great question. Essentially, you're asking about psychology versus epidemiology.
Right.
Why things concern us is a complicated question. It has to do with the fears we bring to asking about epidemics, the anxieties we have about our own behavior, about our own society. Flu is certainly worrisome because of its capacity. Two things: its capacity to change its coat, to change its
to mutate. Right.
Yes, exactly, to mutate. And also because it can move between species relatively fluidly. But is that why it's the greatest concern? I think your question is right, that part of what concerns us is the devastation of 1918. And one reason why I wish we would throw the term pandemic around a lot less is it tends to remind people of 1918 mm-hmm. and think that each time there's an unexpected flu outbreak, anything other than the seasonal flu, which we've become accustomed to, that tens of millions of people are going to die.
Now, certain biological terrors have been sort of arrested because of vaccines. Polio, I think, is one notable example.
Smallpox.
Smallpox, another notable example. But others have been eradicated simply by changing our relationship to the environment. Cholera, which is a huge global problem in the industrialized world, really doesn't exist.
Right.
And it basically involved changing the way we deal with water. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that in our kind of on the way to 9 billion population in the world, that our interaction with the biological environment has shifted, and so suddenly flu and these kinds of viruses create an opportunity that if we were to change our relationship with the environment, they would just go away?
It's impossible to predict what would happen if we changed our relationship to the environment, but you're absolutely right. Diseases, epidemic diseases come and go, sometimes because we do something about them, but much more often because humans change the way that change our own social organizations. We decide to live in cities. We change the way those cities look and are administered. Or we change the way we eat and the way we produce food. And I think that has a lot to do with what we see with flu and potentially gives us an angle on how to change the flu situation.
Hmm. You know, I'm looking at the numbers here, and in a world where there are 6 or 7 billion, I mean, it sounds like a movie ad, in a world where, you know, is it even possible to close borders, to take preventive steps, to you know, circle the wagons and prevent something from happening once it reaches a certain level?
It's probably not possible to make borders impermeable. I'm not sure that that's the answer. I mean, or potentially that's a short-term answer. We saw some of that with SARS in 2003, and you see some suggestion of that here with this current flu situation, inspecting travelers, cautioning people who have come back from Mexico who have a temperature above 100 or so to go to get tested. But that's not, in the long run, that's not going to be the answer. The answer is going to have to be something that goes much more to the principle you just articulated. We have to think about the way we humans interact with the environment, with animals, the international commerce in animals, food, feed, et cetera.
So responsible vigilance, but no panicking. Good advice from Philip Alcabas, a professor of urban public health at Hunter College of City University of New York, and the author of the forthcoming Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian Flu. Thank you very much, Professor. We've been following the developments of gay marriage in places all over the United States. In Iowa, here's this story, Justin. An Iowa judge has waived the 3-day waiting period for getting a marriage license approved, allowing gay couples to marry immediately in that state. And they could start getting married as early as today in the state of Iowa. Who gets married on a Monday, you know? But that's great. It's very happy news. Swine flu has got the world on edge. There's still a lot more we don't know about. We'll continuously update you throughout the morning. We'll have experts and reporters on, and we want you to ask your questions, and we'll try to answer them throughout the day on our website. Miranda emails us. How about, where can I get a vaccine for myself and my family? Are they working overtime to produce vaccines for the entire country? No vaccine yet. Drug makers are working on antivirals. Tamiflu is one. They're ready to make a vaccine, but making one for a new strain can take months. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Lori Garrett talked to us earlier this morning on the issues of Tamiflu and countermeasures for this flu epidemic. If you missed any part of the show, including the Lori Garrett interview, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.